Welcome to Talk Poverty Radio on the WEACT Radio Network and the Progressive Voices Network. I'm Rebecca Vallis. Harvard strikes have come to an end. We'll have a journalist who also worked as a cafeteria worker on Harvard's campus to share his perspective and bring us up to speed. And new analysis finds that if you're serious about family values, you will support policies such as raising the minimum wage, Medicaid expansion, and more. We'll be joined by the economist who did the analysis, as well as a family, to discuss why these policies matter for her and her kids. But first, Jeremy Slevin is back.
Hello.
Jeremy, what's going on? How's
big
life?
News. Life is good. I'm glad to be here. It's better now that I'm in the studio with you.
I mean, it's good to know that life is good because, you know, I am your boss, and clearly you're being honest with me about how life is.
Yes, I'm very honest. No coercion at all.
None at all, especially since it's evaluation time. That's not coming into play at all. Anyway, what's in the news, Jeremy? What's going on?
So news out of the Dakotas. I don't know if people have been following the Dakota Access Pipeline. It's a big oil pipeline that's shipping fracked oil across the Midwest, and members of the Sioux Native American tribe have been protesting this for months, and it came to a face-off last night.
A pretty brutal face-off.
Yeah,
like
so about 117 protesters were arrested last night. Police fired beanbag rounds and pepper spray gas, and said that protesters threw Molotov cocktails at them. The claim of the protesters is that this is going through the land of the Sioux people that was contractually given to them in the 19th century. And there's also environmental criticisms, of course. But
well, something we're going to need to follow for sure. And definitely the environmental aspect. Fracking has obviously been in the news for a long time and now impacting even more marginalized populations.
Right.
There's also news on childcare.
Yeah, so a report from our own organization, the Center for American Progress, took the concept of food deserts and applied it to child care. And they define it as any zip code with more than 30 children under the age of five that doesn't have child care centers, or there are so few centers that, you know, there are more than three times the amount of children in this zip code than there are centers.
So child care deserts.
Right. Literally child care deserts. I think the results were staggering. 42% of kids under five live in these child care deserts. And obviously, that's especially high in rural areas where it's 55%. And for Hispanic populations, many of whom live in rural areas, it's 54%. I think it's just a shocking way. And they did a great, they have a child care calculator to see if you live in a child care desert. It's a fascinating, revealing study.
So it's not just an issue of affordability. It's also an issue of access based on where you live.
Right, right.
So we've also got more kind of another shoe dropping when it comes to citizens being blocked from voting. What's going on in that?
Yes, the shoes keep dropping.
There are so many shoes on this one, Jeremy. So many shoes.
Indiana this week raided a voter registration drive that was registering 45,000 people in Indiana, the vast majority of whom are African American, and apparently without any stated evidence are saying that they're committing voter fraud. And this is a group, it's called the IVRP, who registers voters in low income, low propensity to vote districts. They had already registered 45,000 people. They were going to register about 5,000 more. And the problem is, even, you know, they raided them, even if the case doesn't go to trial for weeks, by then the election's over.
Because thankfully, the election is in about a week.
Thankfully for us, but not thankfully for Indiana.
No, and let me take a guess here that the demographics of the people who are being blocked from voting in this case, are they black?
Yes. As I said, vast majority.
Oh, you said it.
Yes.
Oh, sorry. Maybe I should pay closer attention when you give these news roundups. So, I mean, abysmal stuff, and there are more shoes to drop, I'm sure. We'll probably be having yet more shoes next week to drop.
Yeah. And this particular group has been targeted by Mike Pence, who's the governor in Indiana. So this is not without political overtones.
So homelessness in New York City remains at record highs. What's going on there?
Yeah, so the population, homeless population, has been surging there for years, and Mayor de Blasio made it a big part of his agenda. But it's continued to rise. Last week, it topped 60,000 for the first time ever. There was a 22% rise in the number of homeless kids in New York City public schools. And despite efforts to get people out of shelters, which so far haven't really worked, and prevent evictions, it's rising at untold rates.
And why is this still happening? I mean, there has been a concerted attempt by the de Blasio administration and through the individual he appointed, Stephen Banks,
right,
who actually came from the legal aid world.
Right.
There was a lot of hope. Why is it not working?
So the New York Times actually did a big investigation on this week. And Banks has just been met with a lot of headwinds and a lot of bureaucracy, frankly, in the administration. And they just really hasn't been able to make a huge dent in it. You know, one of the most jarring things is they keep a lot of homeless populations in low-cost motels in New York because it's so overpopulated and there's so many homeless people. It's a dire situation.
Well, I'm pitching myself on a segment for that, so noted. Let's dig in deeper into what's going on the homeless front in New York City. And there also is just a really ugly, horrible finding from a new study looking at legal settlements. What's going on with that?
Yeah, so the Washington Post looked at legal settlements for white males versus females and minorities and low-income people, and found that white male settlements are much higher because the legal system calculates the value. And this is after an injury or a wrongful death when the families seek to claim money, because white male value is calculated as higher.
The value of their lives, literally higher in numerical terms, according to the legal system.
And that is because their wages are higher. But it raises important ethical questions as to whether that means their lives are valued at more.
Well, this is going to be something we're going to dig into next week. So listeners should stay tuned. I want to know a lot more about what's going on there and what the solutions are. And women, we still aren't getting the bucks we deserve. What's new about this?
But there is news about it. So EPI, our friends, the Economic Policy Institute, did a calculation based on both overall inequality and the gender wage gap. And they found that women's wages would be 69% higher if both those things were eliminated. So to put that into context, currently women, their median wage is about $15 an hour. That's what some people think the minimum wage should be, but that's currently what women make, the median. It would be $26 and about 50 cents if inequality and the gender wage gap were eliminated. And they have this cool calculator where you can see how big your individual wage gap is versus a man or a woman.
And a statistic we often repeat on the show, but if we were to close the gender wage gap, we would cut poverty among working women and their families in half. So obviously steps that were long overdue in taking. But, you know, for right now, 80 cents, man. Yeah. 80 cents it is.
Yeah. So, and it fluctuates. You know, it's like 77 cents or 83 cents. No matter where you land, it is enormous.
It's not enormous enough, I think, is the point.
The wage gap is enormous.
My bucks aren't big enough, Jeremy, is what I'm saying. Our bucks. All right. Well, Jeremy, thank you for joining, as I think I can say, as always now, because this has become a staple of the show.
It's now eternity. I think once you reach five times on the show.
We'll close with some sound from the Sandlot forever. Anyway, Jeremy, thank you for coming on. Next up, we'll be digging into the Harvard strikes and what's new there.
You've got us 24 hours a day on your mobile smartphone via the Progressive Voices app. This is the Progressive Voices channel on TuneIn.
You're listening to Talk Poverty Radio on the WEACT Radio Network and the Progressive Voices Network. I'm Rebecca Vallis. Imagine if some of the employees at the wealthiest university on the planet were scrambling to make ends meet. This is the exact issue that took center stage at Harvard University during a strike that lasted for nearly 3 weeks and ended just this week. While Harvard has very deep pockets, the university's endowment is about $35 billion, its dining hall employees received a pre-strike salary that they say hovered around only $31,000 a year. After months of unsuccessful negotiations with the university, these workers had had enough. Here to tell us more about the strike, which ended just this week, is Luke O'Neill, a Boston-based journalist who's been covering the story and who waited on Harvard faculty and students for 10 years. Luke, thank you so much for joining the show.
Thanks for having me.
Well, just to kick things off, I mean, tell us a little bit about the background. This was the first strike in Harvard's 33 years.
Yeah, 33 years. And the last one was also a dining worker-related strike in 1983. That one lasted only one day, and that was during the summer. So this was sort of a big deal that they took this action right in the middle of the semester.
And starting on October 5th, following about 4 months of unsuccessful negotiations, many hundreds of dining hall workers walked off the job. What was going on there? What were they protesting?
Well, there was a couple different issues, but the chief one, the chief concern from, based on most of the dining hall workers that I spoke with, was going to be changes in their health insurance. And now their insurance hadn't changed in 8 years. And what most of them said was that they were really worried about the copay issue and the amount that they were going to have to put into their health insurance. For example, they would be inpatient and outpatient services at a hospital would jump from $0 to $100. Some co-pays would jump from $40 to $100. And so basically they were saying this was too much of a burden for them, especially when you include it with their issues with their wages, which they also say were not fair. The school and the union, it's called Unite Here Local 26, is the union that covers the dining workers at Harvard. And it's a fairly large national union, and they also have dining service and hospitality workers at a number of colleges around here in the Boston area, Brandeis, MIT, Emerson College. They have workers at Fenway Park, Logan Airport. So it's a pretty big union. But the workers at Harvard, they say that while they did make a pretty good wage, all things considered, the fact that they were majority of them were laid off during the summer and other breaks during school, and many of them couldn't collect unemployment during that time, it just didn't amount to a living wage, especially when you consider how expensive it is to live in the Boston area.
And so one of the numbers that has sort of come to light in this debate is that workers have been making an hourly wage of on average $22 an hour, which is higher than their counterparts at many other college dining halls in the region. It also just in raw number terms sounds like not a bad number considering the Fight for 15 is pushing for a $15 minimum wage. Why is that not enough?
Well, as I mentioned, it's not year-round employment, so for very few of them, because naturally a university, there's going to be much fewer students there during the summer and winter breaks and things like that. So many of them were laid off for the summer, and others there was some stipulations in their contract that made it so that they couldn't apply for unemployment insurance during that time. So essentially, they had jobs year round, and they knew that they would be coming back, but they weren't allowed to work for a couple of months a year. So, $22 an hour, sure, that does sound pretty good, but if you're only working, let's say 7.5 months of the year, it doesn't add up to much of a living wage, especially for many of the workers here who I spoke with who have families. $33,000 or $32,000 a year whichever the number we're using for the average, that's nowhere near enough for, you know, a single working adult with two kids, or you know, even two working adults with a couple of kids living in this area.
Now, this is not an issue that's just specific to Harvard. There was actually a study released just a couple of weeks ago looking at the University of California system and finding that nearly half, 45% of employees for the university system reported going hungry at times. So obviously great irony here being that we're talking about dining hall workers going hungry. Do you find that the hardship that results from inadequate wages is similar on Harvard's campus among those workers?
Yeah, from people I talked to, that was similar. I mean, a lot of them, you know, rely on their job for many of their meals. You know, when you work in dining services, that you often, you know, one of the perks of that is that you get to, you know, eat on your break and you know, maybe come in early and things like that. But we've seen this over the years at a number of universities. There was the food services strikes in Yale in 2003. You know, back in the 70s, there was one at MIT here in Cambridge as well, and they went on a 26-day strike. And for some reason, it seems to be the case that a lot of universities don't seem to value the labor of their dining services workers, which is, you know, as one of the students I talked to pointed out, like at Harvard said, you know, universities are always talking about wanting to, you know, fulfill the whole, you know, mind and body of their students. And you can't really, you know, spend too much time studying if you get a hungry stomach. So it's like one of those things that kind of gets swept under the rug. Like, you need to keep your students, you know, fed and nourished. Even though, to be honest, when I was in college, I wasn't eating that healthy. But you know, still, you need something. So it's strange to me that they seem to not value the labor here. And just another thing that, you know, we mentioned a second ago about that $22 number. Harvard said, you know, they pointed out, yes, that is competitive, and you know, in many cases, not that all that bad compared to other universities around. But it's weird because don't often hear a school like Harvard or any school saying good enough is good enough. You know, Harvard is probably the most famous and most prestigious university in the country, if not the world. And it just seems kind of strange for them to say, like, well, you know, we're doing an okay enough job here, so, you know, get off our back. Like, they want to be the best at everything. So this seems like something that they could sort of be a leader in as well.
And of course, one of the issues being raised by the workers, as well as by the students who have joined in calling for higher wages and better benefits for these workers, is, as I mentioned at the top, that Harvard has an endowment of more than $35 billion.
Yes, that's right. And of course, you know, the endowment stuff gets tricky because a lot of that is, when a university gets donations, it's often, you know, the money is tied to a specific thing, so it's not all like liquid that can be moved around. But, you know, according to Harvard, about 30% of their endowment can be shifted around or is liquid. So, you know, I don't know the math right off the top of my head, but that certainly seems like enough to, you know, give a raise to a couple hundred workers.
Now, you wrote a piece in Slate just a week or so ago that was titled that the Harvard Dining Hall Workers' Strike is brilliantly weaponizing students. What did you mean by arguing that the strike and that the workers are weaponizing students?
Well, there seemed to be a lot of support on the campus from students. I went to a walkout last week, and you know, hundreds of students walked out of their classes and filled the center of Harvard Yard, and they were really enthusiastic about supporting the dining service workers. And some of the students that I spoke to talked about this sort of familial bond that they have with the dining hall workers. It's I guess, you know, when you're 18 years old and you go away from home for the first time, you know, the it's sort of natural to form a bond with the people who are feeding you. And then that's what they said. They took on this very friendly relationship with many of these workers who, and, you know, seeing them sort of concerned about their own lives and well-being kind of inspired many of these students to, you know, sort of like they were sticking up for their family. And, you know, obviously it's on a lot of college campuses, you know, students are very enthusiastic about labor issues and strike issues and things like this. But you know, last week when I spoke to one of the student organizers, she said that about 3,000, you know, roughly half of the undergrads had signed a petition supporting the strike. So that's when you're a university, you obviously are a large corporation. They certainly care about their employees, but it's almost more important to care about the opinion of your customers, which in this case is the students. So that may have played a big role, I think, seeing that, you know, the students were unhappy with the way the workers were being treated. I think that probably sort of lit a fire under the administration to come to a resolution with this. Also, this being Harvard, there certainly were numerous schools and disciplines who were looking into this, and a group of students from the medical school analyzed the plan that was offered up by the university, and they basically came to the conclusion that the workers would be better off if they didn't have insurance to work at all and instead just avail themselves of Massachusetts Healthcare Exchange. So in a way, they sort of were utilizing the expertise of you know, many of the brilliant students that they have there to sort of make their case.
So your piece in Slate really highlights the tremendous economic inequality that is really incredibly pervasive on and around Harvard's campus. You describe some of the dining hall workers, many who have worked there for many years. One, Tommy Hardy, a 17-year employee of the dining hall, describes this is day 13. We've got a lot of tired and scared and angry people, but we're here. We're making the best of it. He describes how they're taking a real hit on their pocketbooks because of not being at work. How is the unrest that's been happening on this campus connected at all to the outrage that we see in this political cycle and really stemming from the Occupy protests?
Yeah, it's similar, and it's interesting. It's about the five-year anniversary of Occupy Boston here, so it's been kind of interesting to see some of the parallels. But I don't know, Harvard and Cambridge in general is sort of an interesting place, and Harvard Square in particular. And I think that's what made this story sort of capture, you know, the attention nationally. You don't normally hear too much about dining hall workers' strikes in national news. But Harvard really is this sort of mythical place. You know, from its reputation, but it's also an everyday part of life for people who live around here in Cambridge. And it's just, you know, in like many universities, it's begun to sprawl all over the city. They're buying up all sorts of real estate, and they're moving out into adjacent areas around Boston. So there's some degree of resentment for Harvard, particularly with some of their real estate expansion. And it's also made it really impossible, you know, not to blame Harvard, but it's made it almost impossible to live around Cambridge. And you certainly, you know, on making some of the salaries that these dining workers make, you'd be very hard pressed to find, you know, a place to live anywhere near Harvard, certainly not in Harvard Square. So it's you know, it's easy to look to sort of frame this as the big, bad, you know, powerful corporate university versus the workers. But that's actually literally what this is. It's the richest, you know, university in the world, and they're literally their lowest paid employees. And they didn't seem to want to, you know, meet them halfway and cut them a break. And that's, I think that's sort of a metaphor for a lot of the issues that we're seeing politically with you know, the fight for 15 and a lot of the other, you know, labor-related issues that are going around. You know, Harvard's kind of the villain out of central casting here, but it's also sort of true in a way.
So, and it's, of course, it's not just restricted to the workers, this level of economic inequality. You also describe in your piece a homeless man standing outside of the famous Harvard Coop bookstore, watching the protests and holding a sign that reads, "So this is Monday."
Right. Yeah, it was a really interesting scene that day. And as I also mentioned in the piece, there was a Netflix TV series being filmed, you know, right around the square because, you know, it's very scenic and iconic and everything. So just all these weird stratas of, you know, economics going on from, you know, the Harvard Square, it's sort of, you know, certainly has a significant homeless population. And then, you know, the students, then the workers and the students and then this sort of Hollywood thing going on. It's a really kind of a layer cake of economic disparity going on there. But that also sort of, you know, points to this weird sort of disconnect between, you know, how can you be an institution that is so massively wealthy and, you know, still be trying to pinch pennies when it comes to giving people a livable wage. It's kind of infuriating in a way, but, you know, it's certainly not the only instance of this. And Harvard's certainly not the only, you know, business that is trying to cut costs when it comes to workers.
And what is it like on a university campus when there's that large scale a walkout? We're talking about 750 dining hall workers all walking off the job. What did that do? How did that impact daily life on campus?
Well, that's one interesting thing. We, as I said, you know, a lot of students were in support of it, but, you know, a few that I talked to were saying, and this is about 2 weeks into it, that they, while they were supportive, they were, you know, looking forward to getting back to their normal routine, and it was kind of becoming, you know, a pain in the butt to not be able to go to their dining halls. At Harvard, for undergrads, most of the dining halls are in the, you know, will be in the buildings that the students live in, will be in the residence halls. Eventually they closed, I think, 6 or 7 out of 14, after the strike had already started. So it had some weird effects. On the one hand, the school was trying to staff the dining halls as best they could, but there was kind of interesting, like the Harvard Crimson reported that, you know, they were asking for volunteers and they were having, you know, graduate students fill in and, you know, some of the other dining workers who weren't covered under the union were having to work extra shifts. And I just sort of found that really offensive that they would ask for volunteers to come chip in. Like it was like, you know, the local church bake sale or something and not this massive institution.
So not even just asking for scabs, asking for volunteer scabs.
Right. But also there were some, you know, other reports from students, because a couple of the students organizers I talked to said that they had talked to students who had found, you know, sort of the quality of food dropped significantly, and it was, you know, a lot more frozen food and things like that, and the vegetarian and vegan options were going away, which, you know, you could probably make fun of that as like a problem of privilege, I guess. But
problems of the 1%, right? But you also describe even kids finding bugs in their food.
Right. But that's what I was going to say. There was also things like that. And, you know, I didn't verify any of that. But that there were reports from students that sort of stuff was going on. And which, you know, wouldn't surprise me because people could say, you know, you read criticism of stuff like this and they say anyone could do that. Well, you know, why do they need, you know, $22 an hour? But, you know, certainly it's a lot harder than it looks to feed thousands of people a day.
So now the strikes have come to an end, as we mentioned. There's a deal that's been struck between the university and the workers. What's in that deal, and do you think that it's satisfactory? Is it going to be enough to put these strikes to an end?
Yeah, it looks well. On Wednesday, they voted to approve the new 5-year labor contract. They voted 583-1, so it was pretty overwhelmingly well received. The result, you know, talking to the union, they basically are framing it as we accomplished everything, they said in a statement. And so about 750 employees will receive wages of around $35,000 annually, which is the floor that they were looking for. They will not have to pay anymore for their health insurance. Harvard is going to cover the increased cost in insurance. Let's see, what else do they get? The healthcare plan will not change for another 2 years. In 2019, there will be a copay increases, but that will the burden of that will not fall on the workers. They'll also be given, one thing that they were asking for were stipends over the summer when they weren't working, and Harvard agreed to that as well. So they'll get, some of them will get stipends of between $2,400 and $3,000 over the next few years during the summer. Some of that stuff will depend on, you know, whether you're full time or how long you've been there and that sort of thing. But overwhelmingly, the union seems to be very pleased with what happened.
And I'm curious to hear in the last minute or so that I have with you, what has been the reception in Boston and in Cambridge specifically of all of what's been going on? You yourself are in the position of not only being a journalist, but also having worked in restaurants in Harvard Square, right near campus,
right,
where you've been waiting on Harvard students and Harvard faculty. What has been the reception of the unrest and now the resolution? Is the community paying attention and supportive, or is that not the case?
Well, it's hard to say on the whole, but certainly there was a lot of disruption in Harvard Square. In Harvard Square, for those who don't know, is a very busy commercial neighborhood where the campus is, and there's dozens and dozens of restaurants. And, you know, on the one hand, a lot of the students were probably, you know, going off campus to many of the restaurants, so that was a boon in a way. But I think for the most part, there'll be a lot of people happy to see this, you know, the parade of strikers were all day, every day, marching around the streets, you know, banging pots and pans and blaring sirens. And I think a lot of people will probably be happy to see it over. From my peers and the people I talk to and everyone who's worked in the sort of restaurant and dining service field, we're all seem to be universally supportive. But like I said, there's, you know, when it comes to issues like minimum wages and living wages and things like that, there's a significant portion of people who don't understand why dining service workers deserve to be paid this or that. And so I did see a good amount of criticism of that for them walking off the job. But I think on the whole, everyone will just be happy to see that it's over and you know, the workers are going to get what they asked for. And Harvard, I think, is probably going to be okay either way. I don't think they're in danger of going out of business off of this.
No, and I mean, as you point out in your column, right, we're talking about something that an amount of money here that's probably just, 0.000, who knows how many zeros, right, of a share of their overall endowment. But my last question is, do you think that given this resolution and that the university did actually meet the demands of the workers following this outrage and these walkouts, what does that mean for campuses across the country who are not paying their workers fairly? Are we going to see this kind of progress elsewhere?
Yeah, I certainly, well, the union themselves seems to be optimistic about that. And that's something that they've been stressing in their literature and their statements about the strike. Harvard is, you know, of course, sets an example for you know, many of the schools in the state and, of course, are around the country. So I think that it would be hard not to be optimistic to see this sort of trickle-down pressure or example, you know, spreading out into other schools. And you know, Harvard is an aspirational place for not only for students, but for other institutions who sort of set the pace for. So, you know, I'm tend to be pretty cynical when it comes to these sorts of things, but I think there's reason to believe other schools may look at this, or workers from other schools may look at this and say, hey, why can't we do that too?
Well, here's hoping, and something to watch for sure. I've been speaking with Luke O'Neill. He is a Boston-based journalist who's been covering the Harvard strikes and now the resolution. Thanks so much for joining the show.
Okay, great. Thank you for having me.
Hi, I'm Gianna Garrell from Progressive Voices. Today, the angry roar of the conservative media machine dominates TV and radio, threatening to drown out and push out anyone who dares to discuss our progressive perspectives and ideals. But we can't let that happen. We have too many strong, smart, and important progressive voices who need to be heard. That's why here at PV, we're building a 21st century progressive media universe. One where all the best in progressive media can come together, rise above the static and the noise, and be heard by anyone, anywhere. And we need your help. We're in the middle of a critical campaign to make our dream of 21st century progressive media universe a reality. But we can't do it without grassroots support from people like you. Head over to progressivevoices.com to see how you can help. Please support this important progressive mission, because with your help, we can make sure all our progressive voices are heard.
Welcome back to Talk Poverty Radio on the WEACT Radio Network and the Progressive Voices Network. I'm Rebecca Vallis. Conservatives have for a long time claimed the mantle of family values, but a new report raises questions about what family values look like when it comes to our public policies. Here to talk about this is Kate Gallagher-Robbins. She's the Director of Family Policy at the Center for American Progress, and Yolanda Gordon. She's an occupational therapy assistant at an assisted living facility in Fort Mill, South Carolina, and the mother of three. Kate and Yolanda, thanks so much for joining the show.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you for having me.
So, Kate, I want to start with you just to dig in a little bit to what this report found. What did you look at, and what does it say about this idea that conservatives own family values?
Well, it says quite a bit, actually, and not exactly what you might expect. So my co-author and I, Sean Fremstead, did an analysis of states that were conservative on a set of four policies and states that were progressive. And we looked at family outcomes on a couple of different indicators across these, quote unquote, more conservative and more progressive states. And let me start first with saying, what do we mean by conservative policies here? What are we talking about? And so we're talking about states that have a very low minimum wage of $7.25, states that have anti-union legislation in place that are right-to-work states that have not expanded Medicaid eligibility, and states that have limited reproductive rights. And so if states had done those four things, they fell into our conservative bucket, whereas our progressive states actually had not done any of those four things. And so when we compared these two different states on a bunch of different family indicators, we found that states were actually much better off for families if they had adopted these conservative policies.
So you said that it's not necessarily what one would expect. It definitely is sort of a trope that conservatives, you know, they're the ones who are about families. Would conservatives embrace policies like raising the minimum wage and expanding Medicaid if they were serious? Is that what your report finds?
I mean, that's exactly what we're seeing, that if conservatives want to put their money where their mouth is when it comes to supporting families, they really should be adopting these more quote-unquote progressive policies, which we're seeing are very helpful for families across the board on a number of different indicators.
So, Yolanda, I want to bring you in to sort of help us connect the dots here about why these kinds of economic policies make a difference for families. So tell us a little bit about your experience trying to balance your work with raising your family.
Well, being a single parent of three special needs kids, it's always a very precarious balancing act. It's making choices like, do I take the day off because I feel sick, or do I save this day because I know that my child may have to have a procedure a couple of months down the road.
And that obviously speaks to whether or not you have something like paid leave or paid sick days, not necessarily one of the policies, Kate, that you and your report co-author looked at, but definitely related. Yolanda, are your wages something that also create challenges for you in raising your family?
In the past, that has been a huge barrier for my family and myself. The last job that I worked before I graduated from college, I only made $13 an hour, but it was a job that I was only allowed to work 25 hours a week. So it wasn't full-time employment. So with $13 an hour, only 25 hours a week, no insurance benefits, no paid leave, it was always a choice between do I go to work for my 5 hours and try to schedule and make fit my day around what my children need, or do I just take the day off and go without pay?
And so you're making more than minimum wage now is what you're saying, but is that enough for you to be able to make ends meet?
Now it's enough for me to make ends meet if I have the hours. Being in the healthcare industry and the job that I do, sometimes we have patients and sometimes we don't. Right now we're kind of in a downward swing. So I could, like last week, I worked 9 hours. So, you know, I have to equate 9 hours and figure out how I have to shift my budget to make everything work.
And so, Kate, bringing you back in, it's obviously not just Yolanda. What you've been looking at is broad trends here. What do we know about the connection between wages and family strength?
No, that's a great question. I mean, for families, having just money to be able to bring more stability to their everyday lives, to be able to save for those little emergencies that we know that everybody faces from time to time, to be able to invest in their children's education, their own health, as Yolanda is citing. I mean, those are really critical for families. And there are different academic studies that speak to the fact that increased wages do increase family stability and reduce, for example, marital conflict or conflict between children and parents. And I think sometimes that doesn't get enough attention when we're talking about family values, that people see that as a really cultural trope, when in fact, it's undergirded by all these financial situations and all the contexts that you're in. And unfortunately, South Carolina, where Yolanda lives, is one of the states that has not raised its minimum wage and has this anti-union legislation in place, both of which lead to worse jobs and in some ways the types of jobs Yolanda's talking about that have these really volatile schedules and can be very difficult for families to juggle.
And Yolanda, I mean, you've been describing sort of a chaotic existence, right, of not being able to control your hours. What kind of emotional toll does that take, not just restricting your financial resources, but what does it mean for you and your family emotionally?
For me and my family particularly, I know I'm always exhausted. My children are always you know, especially financially, looking at, you know, whether they can afford to go on a field trip or whether or not, I can buy them a new pair of shoes. So they look at it from the standpoint of what mom can provide for them. I look at it from the standpoint of, you know, how much can I put in my grocery budget for this month? If I can buy a new pair of shoes for my child, can I pay for them to go on the field trip that costs $16? I have a senior in high school this year, buying her graduation invitations and her cap and gown and just paying for, you know, not only the necessities, but the things that come up during the school year that, you know, you don't automatically put in your budget because you don't know that they're coming. So, again, always exhausted. I often crash around 9 o'clock at night. I barely have time to myself most days. Sometimes I'm up at 4 a.m. just trying to get things taken care of so that I know that things will go a little smoother when I get home in the afternoon and I can help all three with their homework.
And Kate, scheduling unpredictability, this has become a problem that's really widespread throughout low-wage industries.
That's absolutely right. And one of the reasons we honestly didn't look at scheduling in our report is there hasn't actually been enough legislation in states to combat this problem, which we know is a growing issue for, particularly as Rebecca's citing, in low-wage work. And that's, you know, predominantly women, predominantly people of color, and young people who are often the ones that are very much trying to raise their families. They have young children and they're trying to balance, you know, being called into work at the last minute or not being offered enough hours with school responsibilities or childcare responsibilities. And it makes it really difficult and stressful for families. And there's been some research that's really shown that it's not just the parents that are stressed out by these volatile and unpredictable schedules, it's also the kids as well, and that that has behavioral outcome implications, it has academic outcome implications. And I think often we don't make these connections between what's happening in a parent's workplace and what that means for kids. But there actually are some really deep-seated connections there, because of course that all comes back to what the home life looks like and the amount of stress that folks are facing. So yeah, I think scheduling is an area that we really need to be paying more attention to, and frankly that states and the federal government need to be doing more work on.
So, Yolanda, you also mentioned that health insurance is a very real challenge in your and your family's life. Tell us a little bit about that aspect of what you guys are facing.
My children, like I said, are all special needs, all three of them. So they qualify for a particular Medicaid program here in South Carolina that takes some of the burden off of me for their medical expenses. But in terms of my medical expenses, my deductible for my insurance is $3,000. So I would have to pay the $3,000 out of pocket before my insurance will pick up any of the things other than preventative things, such as physicals and those types of things. So it gets a little tough trying to decide, do I go to the doctor because I don't feel well and I know that it's something I should be seen for, or do I just kind of tough it out and try to fix it myself? And there are a lot of families that have to make those choices, because financially $3,000 is a burden. And trying to go to the doctor and knowing that you have to pay this bill out of pocket before you can, at some doctor's office actually will make you pay before you leave. And you know that you don't have the money to do it, or trying to schedule doctor's visits around, you know, the 2 weeks that you have more money in your paycheck to make sure that you can afford it. It's a burden, and it gets harder, you know, every day to try to make it possible. And, you know, I live in South Carolina. They did not expand Medicaid, so there are a lot of families that can't afford to even buy insurance in the marketplace.
And Kate, health insurance was one of the things that you looked at in this report, specifically states that had expanded or not expanded Medicaid. What is the link there to what families are experiencing?
Yeah, well, there's a very serious link between having health insurance and lacking it for families. And when a family member doesn't have health insurance, you know, obviously that leads to financial burdens. It leads to elevated stress, worse health outcomes, and it leads to family instability. You know, this can lead to parents splitting up, couples deciding that they're better off being apart. And I think all of those things are, excuse me, tied back together. And when states like South Carolina are leaving particularly adults out in the cold by not expanding their Medicaid programs when they really have a very great and valuable opportunity to do so right now, you know, that's really hurting family stability in those states. And I think that's something that folks aren't often talking about when they're thinking about health outcomes. They're not thinking about how deeply tied that is to how the family is functioning on a daily basis. And obviously it's critical that children have the health insurance, as Yolanda is citing, but, you know, their parents need to be healthy as well, and they need to have their opportunities to make sure that they're taken care of in an affordable way. And so I think that that's a really critical aspect that states are ignoring when they are making these decisions to not expand their Medicaid program.
And it's not just whether the family is healthy, it's actually whether the family is staying together.
Absolutely. No, it's your health is, and it's so tied to the relationships as well. And then the other aspect of health insurance that we talked a little bit about in the report is access to reproductive care as well. And we know states have come down hard. A lot of states have come down very hard on reproductive rights in the last several years and have made real efforts to roll back access. And that's a real challenge for families as well. You know, people often, I think of that as kind of just a women's issue and a women's right. And that's true, but it's also true that it affects the families more broadly, right? So when families can plan if and when they're going to have children, and that's linked to educational attainment, it's it's linked to lifetime earnings, and all of those things can help improve family stability. So I think that's another connection with family values that conservatives often don't see reproductive rights and reproductive justice as a quote-unquote family values issue, but these things are deeply linked together.
I'm speaking with Kate Gallagher-Robbins and Yolanda Gordon, a mother of three in South Carolina, about new analysis looking at the link between state economic and health policies and family strength and stability. You're listening to Talk Poverty Radio. Yolanda, so what types of things would make it easier for you to manage at home and to support your family? What are the kinds of policies that you would want to see if you could be queen for a day?
If I could be queen for a day, definitely paid leave for families would be, it's mother and father. I have, in my experience, after having my youngest daughter in 2005, I had to go back to work after 2 weeks because I had no leave. I had no paid days that I could stay out of work with her longer. Definitely more affordable or lower deductibles on health insurance. That would be more helpful to families, in looking at the broad scheme of things, especially now that we have the Affordable Care Act. You know, building in something that says that deductibles can't be, more than, I would say $1,500 would be more reasonable than $3,000. And just, expanding the safety net program for families, because families out there, even working class families, have hard times. And some of them are often one, flat tire away from, being back in poverty. And also, raising the minimum wage to $15 would be definitely beneficial, especially to young families, and definitely for my daughter, expanding access to reproductive health care, because my daughter's 17, she'll be 18 next year, and she'll eventually lose her insurance. So that's going to be something that, we're going to have to look at for her. Going into college.
And Yolanda, you mentioned the safety net, which we haven't talked about yet in this discussion, and which wasn't one of the things that was explicitly looked at in your analysis, Kate. But safety net programs obviously do a lot to improve financial security for families. What kinds of programs have been important for you, and what would you want people to know about the truth about those programs?
Definitely the SNAP program was very beneficial to my family while I was finishing college. Like I said, I couldn't find a full-time job. I was working part-time, and it was just hard to make sure that, we stayed afloat. I was able to go to school, and also that, I was able to put food on the table. Also, the Earned Income Tax Credit was beneficial in helping me pay some of my tuition. It also was beneficial in helping me pay for childcare after school. And definitely, having two children with autism, helping pay for some of the supplies that they need that are just a little bit above and beyond what you would typically need for your children.
And SNAP, of course, being the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, formerly known as food stamps. So, Kate, what do you want the takeaways from this report to be, and what are you hoping that policymakers learn from this kind of evidence?
I think there's a couple of takeaways. One, in the broad political context, is we need to rethink what we mean when we say family values and family supportive policies. And we need to take a close look at policies like these economic and health policies that Sean and I analyzed in our report and recognize the important role that they play in stabilizing and helping make families secure and healthy. So I think that that's one element of it. And then, of course, from the policy standpoint, states need to take action. I mean, there is a lot that they can be doing to support families that are good, not only for families' pocketbooks, but just for their lives in general. And I think we need to take a strong look, and they need to take action on putting these policies into place, making sure women and their family members have access to health care, have access to reproductive rights. And that's what states need to be doing going forward as they're looking to not only improve their bottom lines, but help keep families together.
And obviously there's a role for Congress there as well when it comes to at least raising the minimum wage. And Yolanda, just to ask a question in a fairly candid way, but I think it's worth naming and sort of using some of the terms that that some of the opponents of these policies often use, they sometimes like to tell people in your position that you wouldn't be facing the struggles that you're facing if you would just work a little harder, and if you would even just get married, because that would be the difference between struggling and not struggling. What would your response to people who say those kinds of things be?
I've actually had that response from from Senator Tim Scott's office. And my response to them was, I've served my country. I was in the United States Army. I know how to work hard. I've been working since I was 17 years old. Working hard is not the problem. What the problem is that you have employers that only want to hire part-time employees, that don't want to hire full-time employees that can do the job and often are more willing to do the job than some people that aren't motivated. And I also, had to tell them that I've been married. I am divorced. I've been divorced for 11 years. And marriage is not always the solution. What is the solution is, making sure that families are supported and that, moms like myself can still maintain a working household without having all the stresses that we have, because we either don't have enough work, we don't have enough hours, or we just don't have enough money to feed our children.
And if I could ask, what was the response of the senator's office when you gave them a piece of your mind?
It was very respectful. The gentleman that I was speaking to, I actually asked him had he ever been married, which he responded no. And I, told him that in a lot of cases, and especially in my case, marriage does not encourage marriage. It actually, for me, discourages marriage, because my marriage did not end on good terms, and it was not a very good situation for my children or myself. And that since my divorce, we have been healthier and we have been happier, and we've done 10 times better than we did while I was married. I'm sorry, I'm standing outside. And I also informed them that, because of the programs that we were specifically talking about, that I'm their return on investment, that not only did I, was I able to use the safety net programs, not only was I able to go to college, but I was able to go to college, get out of college, and secure a job. And, that they should look more at the return on investment as opposed to making suggestions that women like myself or men like myself get married.
Yolanda Gordon is an occupational therapy assistant at an assisted living facility in Fort Mill, South Carolina, and the mother of three children with disabilities. Kate Gallagher-Robbins is the director of family policy at the Center for American Progress. And I can't thank you ladies enough for joining us for Talk Poverty Radio.
Thank you.
And that's our show. Thanks for listening to Talk Poverty Radio, broadcasting from the heart of Anacostia in Washington, D.C. You can catch us weekends at 11 a.m. on the WEACT Radio Network. You can also catch us Saturdays, 11 a.m., and Sundays at 10 a.m. on the Progressive Voices Network via the TuneIn app.
You can also subscribe to Talk Poverty Radio as a podcast via iTunes. And feel free to pitch us on Twitter at the handle @TalkPoverty or email us at info@talkpoverty.org. See you next week.
I work and get paid like minimum wage. Sights to hit the clock by the end of the day. Hop from downtown into the hood where I stay the only place.